Hey, Risto here, George Mason University. I'm here with Jennifer Agins. Let's start that again. Agins, is that correct?
You actually are the only person in the history of the world that's pronounced it right on the first try.
Man, I should have just rolled with it. All right.
So yes, it's Agins.
Agins. Okay. Now that you say it, now I'm going to say it wrong.
You can use the first one. Splice it.
Hey, Risto here, George Mason University. I'm here with Jennifer Agins from Pennsylvania State University, and we're here to discuss an article titled Self-Determination Through Circus Arts, Exploring Youth Development in a Novel Activity Context. This was published in Journal of Youth Development, which often is open access, so you can just click on the link and you can find the full citation of the article in the notes, and I'll go right to it, so if you want to read that. Jennifer, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
So initially, Donal Howley connected me with your work, and I found it super interesting because the words youth development is what I kind of research as well. And then I saw circus arts and I'm like, how does circus work into all of this? So it was instantaneously, I was like, okay, I got to read this article and have you on. I will ask you in a moment how you got into circus arts, but I think it's important for people who are listening to understand what we mean by circus arts. So what is a circus arts program for youth?
Yes. So circus arts encompasses a really wide variety of forms of creative movement, things like aerials, which would be like your trapeze, things that fly through the air. Equilibristics, which is a fancy word for balance stuff. So like tight wire and unicycle riding. Object manipulation, there's juggling is the most common thing people think of there. Acrobatics, like tumbling or creating human pyramids where you climb on each other. And then character work or clowning. And all of these things together, often an individual person might specialize in one or two of these areas, but often circus programs will teach across this full spectrum or across many of these areas so that a young person participating in the program, which would be different from like a soccer program, everyone plays soccer in the soccer program. In the circus program, you might have an aerialist and a juggler and a clown who are all specializing in different aspects of circus, but all working together within that circus program. So it's a very collaborative space. It's a very creative space. And for a lot of people, the word circus immediately conjures up like P.T. Barnum and elephants or Cirque du Soleil or maybe both. And I think it's important to acknowledge that those are types of circus and it's a much more diverse art form than that. So you can think of it similar to how if I say dance, you might picture ballet and someone else might picture tap and someone else pictures hip hop. Circus arts is a label that can encompass a lot of different types of movement activity.
And it's good that you gave that description of kind of like a broad, like P.T. Barnum. Like I think of elephants and the humans not doing much at all because the focus is on the animals, which the animals are gone, I think now. But then Cirque du Soleil, like the epitome of like athleticism, like the top tier people who know how their body moves and is able to do amazing things. And obviously there's everything in the middle of that as well. So it's definitely, I see the connection to physical education and physical activity. Random question, can you juggle?
I am actually a juggler, so yes. I can juggle five balls. I can juggle fire.
Wow.
Et cetera.
I spent our study abroad program in Brazil. One of the other teachers knew how to juggle and she tried to teach me and I went through the whole thing and I got to maybe keeping three balls in the air for like 5 seconds, but it was defeating. And I wish that is a skill that I teach to like elementary education students, like pre-service teachers, because it's something that some people just struggle with. And they try and they try and they try and it's like, okay, that feeling that you're having right now is the feeling that a kid who can't shoot a basketball correctly, even though you teach them exactly how to do it, they just are struggling. And I think things like that, and I think maybe in circus arts, like certain things that you teach are so outside of traditional ball sports, like kick the ball, bounce the ball, shoot the ball kind of stuff. So
yeah, and I think that that comment touched on a bunch of things that are interesting and important, I think, about circus from a PE and just research on movement perspective, research and practice on movement perspective. Certainly the struggle, like this is a lot of people who teach circus arts in recreational spaces will talk about the benefit, not just to your physical body, but to things like learning how to persevere, learning how to move through those feelings that we all get, whether it's the struggle of learning to juggle or the potential, the fear of being at height, the trust of other people when you are climbing on them or you're spotting each other or creating a collaborative piece of art, like a performance. There's a lot of developmental growth in addition to the physical growth that's happening. And then with the teaching it to PE teachers, my co-author on this paper, Jackie Davis, who actually was my PE teacher and my circus mentor, which gets back to how I learned circus, Jackie taught me in school. And she actually conducted some research in 2008. She did a survey with PE teachers to ask how many teachers in U.S. public schools include something that could be considered circus in their PE curriculum. And it was surprisingly common. A lot of people are teaching something that you could see in a circus.
Can you give some examples of that?
So a lot of people teach juggling. Yeah. Is like the most obvious one. But you could also, for example, go to a Cirque du Soleil show and see people performing with hula hoops or walking on stilts or jump rope tricks. So maybe you're teaching some basic double dutch, and on Cirque du Soleil, they're doing flips in the double dutch. But it's the same, like this could be seen in a circus, right? So she defined it really broadly in that survey just to see, like, is it possible that circus is already in PE? And it really already is, to this extent of like people are teaching juggling. Maybe it's just scarf juggling, but people are teaching juggling. People are teaching some of these skills. Much less common is incorporating things like character work and clowning, or incorporating an actual show. So you might teach juggling, but maybe your kids never perform it. Some room to expand more circus into PE. And I'll actually just quickly pitch an article that just came out this year in the Journal of Physical Education, Recreation and Dance by Wenzel and colleagues, that provides like straightforward tips for here's how you can implement an elementary physical education circus unit that's aligned with national PE standards. So I'll give you that for the show notes if folks are thinking, wait, I want to do this in my PE classes.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll definitely link that. When I was collecting my dissertation data outside of New York City, took the Metro North up, and I was a school district just north of the city, and they had a circus arts unit, because the Big Apple Circus that was kind of up near there had a huge influence, and they had an education program that they trained physical education teachers on how to teach all these different things. And they had like the stilts, they had the unicycles, they had the equipment to actually do way more than the teaching in isolation, this juggling skill. Like they had a lot of stuff. And I realized through there, I was like, oh, this can be like really, really amazing for developmental, like just, you know, physical literacy or just your ability to understand how to balance and do fundamental movement skills, but with all these extra like levels of difficulty. And so it was super cool, and it's really like the students loved that unit. If you can imagine going into an elementary school and saying, hey, the circus is in physical education this month, you know?
Totally. And that's actually quite common. Circus programs as a recreational activity, which is what we were studying in this article, are really an increasingly common form of recreation in the U.S. We have an industry survey conducted every 2 years by the American Youth Circus Organization and American Circus Educators Association. And in the 2022 survey, they featured 197 organizations in 38 states. And you can see the growth in these organizations by the fact that 78% of those were founded after the year 2000 and 50% were founded after 2010. So there's like increasing growth in the number and the prevalence of these programs. And a lot of them will do outreach into local schools, whether that's having the teacher from the circus school go into the PE classroom or have the kids come to visit the circus school and get to try things there. There can be a lot of great collaboration between the recreational and the in-school sectors.
Yeah, and going into your study, so for people who are listening, there's a self-determination and a positive youth development podcast already that we've done. So we won't have to go too far into that. So if you don't understand those two theories, you can listen to those podcasts. They're fairly short. But I'm wondering if you can share, like, with your research, what was the main question that you aimed to answer when you started conducting this study?
Yeah, so the main thing we wanted to do was really just examine some positive youth development factors within the context of these youth circus programs, because as I mentioned, my second author in this paper was my circus coach, who also has a master's in education and was doing some research towards a doctorate. So, from a research lens, but we have this practice heart to it, right? Like, we know, we've seen it, we've lived it, and we weren't seeing in the research what we saw happening in practice. There was no documentation of what was happening. So this really felt like a first step towards what I'm hoping will continue to be a growing research area. And we do see this. I can give you a whole bibliography if you want for the show notes, but you can also just put circus into Google Scholar, youth circus into Google Scholar. And there's a really growing field of scholars that are looking at this. But at the time that we were conducting this study, there wasn't quite as much happening. And a lot of the work in youth development, as I think has been covered across your podcast, and certainly Nick Holt talked about this in his episode on PYD. Nick was on my dissertation committee, so it was fun to go back and listen to his podcast. he was talking about, so positive youth development, just for those who haven't listened to that episode, is an approach to youth development that focuses on supporting strengths. So we're trying to think, what's going right in the lives of youth and how do we enhance that? And it's been used a lot in general out of school time youth programs. It's been used a lot in sport. In the arts, it's a little bit, people are using different terminology a little bit, or they're lumping arts programs in with other types of youth development programs. And circus is like an arts, but also a physical activity, and it sort of gets lost in the shuffle. So we wanted to sort of make the case that this could be an interesting context to study because it is so different from sport, but also so different from other types of youth development programs. Maybe there's something happening here. And spoilers, we found some interesting stuff. We'll get to that later.
How did you get there? What was the kind of like the methods of the study that you conducted?
Yeah, so we did a survey. We had a little over 100 youth participated in our survey, and we started our data collection at the National Youth Circus Festival that's hosted by the American Youth Circus Organization. And then we got some additional participants who were members of that organization. The kids were having way too much fun at the festival to want to take a survey, so we needed to increase our sample size a little bit with getting some of them after they went home. But we just asked them about their experiences in their circus programs. So we asked them things, like, how long have you been in the program? What types of circus things do you do? And then questions about, the different youth development variables that we were interested in. So we asked about positive youth development. We asked about their like emotional experiences, their autonomy, competence, and relatedness, which gets back to self-determination theory, sort of casting a wide net, because again, we were seeing good things happening in circus programs, but we weren't coming in necessarily with a hypothesis. There's no control group that we're testing this against. It was just like, we think positive youth development is happening here. Let's check.
So the American Youth Circus Organization was kind of the what you were studying in a way, like that. That's the organization that you are at least a part of, and you're as a board member, right? So can you explain a little bit more about what that is? Is it like Shape America for physical educators? Is it like a board? Does it make standards? Does it have like consequential decisions, or is it a
great
relations board? What is it?
So AICO, the American Youth Circus Organization, was founded in 1998 just to be a place like circus educators working with youth were sort of feeling like, am I the only one doing this? Right? It was not a very common thing then. And so they came together for community and for sharing best practices. And it has grown immensely. I currently chair the board, so I could go on and on about the great things that we're doing. But I'll just say it's not like a national governing body like you have in sport, because circus people are very independent and creative and want to do their own thing. We're not trying to create standards to say, like, you must teach unicycle this way or anything like that. But we do have a safety program where programs can work with us to be recognized and have an independent consultant come in and support them in developing best practices given their space and their population and what they're doing. So a little more customizable. And we also host festivals like the one where we collected these data. We provide a lot of professional development resources for the community, that kind of thing. So it's like an umbrella organization for all of the different people who are doing circus education across the country.
Okay. So when we talk about what you actually found, you found a lot of positive outcomes, such as grit, which is a very buzzy word from Angela Duckworth. And that, like, around that time, 17, 18, 19, that was like, I mean, she was on all the podcasts and all the shows about this word. But you found outcomes such as grit and positive youth development for youth who participated in youth circus in your study. So I'm wondering if you can kind of expand on the findings and explain a little bit more about the results of your study and how it aligns with what we previously know about these areas.
Yeah. So a lot of what we found was what we expected given research in other youth programs. And they're actually not published in the peer-reviewed literature, but there was a study done by the Weikert Center for Youth Program Quality, where they have a standard measure of program quality for after-school programs. And they did their standard observation protocol in a group of 8 circus programs across the United States. And they found that the program quality in these programs was as high or higher than their like benchmark for exemplary programs. So we were not surprised to find that the youth in our study also showed good outcomes on all of the things that we were expecting. And we were also not surprised to find some of the relationships among variables, like that the satisfaction of the basic psychological needs for competence, autonomy, and relatedness was positively associated with PYD, positively associated with positive affect, negatively associated with negative affect, those types of things. The interesting piece, and again, this is a very exploratory study, right? This is a new population to be looking at. So we sort of threw a lot of things in the pot here. But what we found that was really interesting was with regard to relatedness. So in self-determination theory, we have these 3 basic psychological needs that I've been mentioning a little bit here. And often in physical activity research and sport research and exercise research, people use this theoretical framework, and they often find that autonomy and competence are really important for physical activity, for maintenance of a physically active lifestyle. So we were really surprised to find that in our study, relatedness was the strongest predictor of intrinsic motivation for participating in the circus program. They still had autonomy and competence, but the strength of the relatedness in this population was something really different from what we were seeing in other physical activity spaces. And we think that's connected to like what circus is and why circus is different than some other types of physical activity. The artistic component, the fact that we're not competing, we're collaborating, and that we're trying to produce something. You know, maybe you're producing a show that's going to be presented in your community, which is a little bit different than like Friday Night Lights, right? You're still in front of the community, but it's in a different kind of way.
The community's not cheering for one group to win over the other. It's a performance that, I mean, I don't know if, I mean, some members of the community might be rooting for them to succeed, but they're just kind of there to watch. And that's like, if I look at just a play or a ballet performance or something, I don't go there to say, oh, I hope they really nail this. It's there and you watch versus yeah. I go watch a football game or a soccer game and I know somebody on one team. I'm like, I hope this team wins and I hope they do really well, you know?
And it's possible for them to disappoint you. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And then even if you don't perform with the circus arts, there's still so much relatedness, so much trust and working together that just has to happen for the circus to function, right? If I'm going to learn to ride the unicycle, I need someone to spot me so that I don't fall and hurt myself. If I'm going to climb up into the air, I need somebody who's going to make sure that I'm safe in that position. You know, if we're going to stack three people on top of each other, we all need to work together and trust each other really well. So that type of relatedness in other research, we've also found to be a really strong component of just like what circus is. And one great example of that is a recent paper that came out this year. The lead author is my graduate student, Farah Adolfova. She did research about youth voice in circus programs. So how much do young people feel like they're being heard, that their opinions matter, that people are listening to them? And maybe what are these programs doing that could facilitate that? And one of her biggest findings was just the importance of this sense of belonging, the sense of community. And a lot of times, you know, we were talking at the beginning about like, what is the reputation of circus, right? It's a space for people who don't necessarily fit in other places. And that cultural lineage, I guess, of like, this is a space for outsiders is still, I think, really important. Even when we're doing circus in PE, it's like, you might be the star of the basketball team, but you might be just as bad at juggling as the kid who's never been able to get the ball through the hoop, right? It sort of levels the playing field a little bit to put people in new situations. And often we find that kids who don't really feel like they have a physical activity that works for them can find something in circus because it is so diverse. So maybe there's someone who their initial thing that they're drawn to is clowning, where they want to express themselves more through character work and not so much with object manipulation or strength-based activities. They're still an essential part of the circus performance, right? You're not left out because you can't throw and catch a ball. You are important to this show. So I think that piece of community is also really important.
And it provides a lot of choices. Like if you don't force the kids to do every single thing, and this is you work in stations, you do this. It's like, okay, here's some stations here. Here are how you can do all of these stations safely. And this is the instruction for each. But once you figure out and once you give everything a shot, and then you can focus in on something else to perfect it. Whereas, you know, something like that's done all over the place, like a 16 lesson sport education basketball unit. If you go in and you don't like basketball, it's tough. And the word, yeah. And there's just not a lot of like nowhere to really hide. Like you are put on the spot at some point to figure out how to play basketball. So,
yeah. So we weren't surprised that relatedness was strong in this population. But we think it's a really important finding because without looking at this population, the literature was saying in physical activity, competence and autonomy are important and relatedness is a nice bonus. And we're saying, well, it matters actually the type of activity. In some activities, relatedness might not be as important, right? If you're going to the gym and lifting weights, it might not matter whether you feel like you have a community there. It's the sense of competence and autonomy with the weightlifting that's making you want to come back. With other activities like circus, it might not matter how competent you feel. If you feel related, that's what's primarily driving the intrinsic motivation for the kids in our sample.
And it is interesting how you talked about the idea that circus has a whatever the reputation that they have is that they're a little bit non-traditional. So people who don't feel like they fit in, they relate. So they're bringing in that, like, they're like, oh, you feel like you don't belong and I don't feel like I belong. Maybe we belong together in this place. And that's where you feel way more comfortable doing these activities. So I'm wondering, and this may be a current study or a future study, that when we talk about programs like elementary school, like circus arts units, does that theory and does that relatedness then carry over? Because the circus arts are like, you have to decide, you have to ask your parents' permission to drop you off at the circus camp, or somehow you have to get there. But when you put it into a place where everybody goes to school at this age, and you're no longer necessarily given that, like, I feel like this is my calling. It's like, this is what you're doing for the month. Has anybody looked at SDT through that kind of lens?
So less in SDT, but there is a really amazing circus integrated PE program happening in Manitoba public schools right now. And Dr. Dean Krelars and his group are studying that program, as well as they have some research on a circus-based PE program that was in Montreal. And their work is more in the physical literacy space. But they have found that motor competence and physical literacy they're enhanced more, I guess, what is it? The circus-based PE classes are really good for physical literacy and motor competence. And in particular, they reduce the gender gap compared to regular PE. So we know, especially once we get into middle school, we start to see girls not as engaged and not performing as well as the boys in PE. So once they were in the circus-based PE classes, that gender gap was not as visible in the circus-based PE.
So what were your differences in gender in your study? And what do you feel like that kind of gender issue, were there differences? And if so, what do you think the implications are for that?
Yeah, we found a few gender differences, like higher levels of our measure of concentration among female participants, which I think tracks with what we would expect. But we also have a really interesting flip-flop in self-perceived competence among our girls. So in this study, we had a pretty wide range of ages. And the girls who were ages 16 to 18 felt much less competent than the boys. The girls who were ages 19 to 21 felt much more competent than boys of the same age. So this dip in the girls' self-perceived sense of competence, right? This is not measuring whether they can or cannot juggle five balls. This is saying, do you think you're competent? You know, that 16 to 18 year old dip in self-perceived competence, I think also tracks with what we would see across the board. But it was interesting to see the 19 to 21 year old girls, they were through the roof in their sense of self-perceived competence. And you know, this is not a longitudinal study. These aren't the same girls, but it does make me wonder, like, if we can keep the young people in the program after high school, if they you know, maybe it's the relatedness, maybe it's something else, but to keep them around, there could be the potential for this additional growth there. I mean, we don't have enough data in this study to say what's causing these differences. I think a lot of it is going to be larger socialization factors. But Dr. Krielaar's work is a little bit more, they've got longitudinal data, they've got some more in-depth observation of the actual program, and they've got a comparison group. So the PE circus and the PE regular old PE, being able to compare those. And the most recent work there is actually done by Dr. Krielaar's student, Adam Woolley. He found that circus-based PE also led to more positive emotions like pride and enjoyment compared to regular PE. So lots of evidence suggesting that we should have more circus in our PE.
Yeah. And do you think that, again, that is the place that you interviewed them, they had a choice, that they had a choice to do it and they might be more inclined to like it? Does that make sense? Like so my colleague and I were doing a research study and going to a bunch of schools about elective PE. So in Virginia, 9th and 10th grade PE is mandatory. You take 9th, you take health and physical education through 10th grade, and then you're 11th grade and it's 12th grade. There's no requirement of PE. But we're going to these schools that like 240 students out of 400 juniors and seniors are in some sort of elective PE. They're going to weight training and they're going to advanced PE. They're going to all these different things. And I just find it curious because, you know, there's a lot of literature that shows a lot of kids don't want to be in 9th grade PE because it's mandatory. It's like, you have to do this, you have to be here. But then, you know, you graduate 18 years old, you're 18 years and 3 months and you're on a college campus and all of a sudden you have choice and you can do all these different things. So, you know, you talked about student voice a lot of times, not all the time, but a lot of times those are conflated together and they are almost said to be the same thing, even though they're not. So like the student voice, student choice, if you give students choice, you're not necessarily valuing their voice, but you can. So do you think that some of your results, especially with the gender differences, like is because those students chose to be there?
Yeah, I mean, this is a problem we have in all recreation research, right? Because you can't do a randomized control trial where you assign a kid to play soccer in 9th grade and expect that that kid's soccer experience is going to be the same as a kid who's been playing soccer since he was 5. Like that's not how soccer works. It's not something you can just randomize. So we definitely have this, there's a self-selection factor in all out-of-school time research. I think the additional piece with a lot of these participants is that they were not just participating in this thing after school, but they also traveled to this national festival. So they're really engaged. I mean, that's true for the kids across every age group and every gender in this study, that they they were enough invested in circus that they wanted to get more of it. They wanted to meet other circus kids from across the country. So certainly it's a population that we wouldn't say is representative of all kids who do circus. And then I guess even within that, it's interesting that we still found these differences. So certainly more work to be done here.
Yeah. So in regards to age, were there differences you found with like autonomy and competence based on how old that student was?
Yes. And this is something I've also seen in research, not with circus kids, like research at summer camps and that kind of thing, where there's some interesting age differences when you use self-perceived competence and autonomy, right? So autonomy, as you would expect, is much lower for the 10 to 12-year-olds compared to the youth ages 16 and older. Right? If you can drive a car, you have more autonomy than someone who can't. That's just the way of the world, right? But self-perceived competence, I regularly find being really high the younger the kids are. So when you've got a 10-year-old and you ask them, are you good at stuff? They go, yeah. Right? And you ask a 15-year-old, are they good at stuff? And they're like, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not good at anything. This world is terrible.
Right? Yeah. So it's like as their brains are maturing, as their ability to compare to the rest of the world, as their social media exposure increases, they're starting to put themselves in a new reference group compared to, do I think I'm awesome? Yeah, I think I'm awesome. That was an interesting finding. And then because this is at this national festival, it could also be that there could be some real differences where, within, let's say we're both in a youth circus program, who's going to go to the national festival? If you're really young, it could be like, well, I'm really good and I'm really young and I want to like dive into this really deeply. Or it could be like, I'm 15 and I think it'd be fun to meet some other circus kids. I don't care how good I am at this. Like, I just want to go on this adventure. So there could also be different motivations for like who attends the festival.
So the youngest kids, practical question, the youngest kids, they're going there. Is it an overnight camp? Is it like, are parents with them? Like, I can understand 21-year-olds, you're like, just get yourself there and this is where you sleep and that's what it is.
Well, the way we run our national festivals at ICO is it's usually like a 3-day festival held at a circus school somewhere in the country. So we actually just did one in August at the circus school Senka in Seattle, Washington. So if you're in Seattle, go check out Senka, the School of Acrobatics and New Circus Arts. It's what Senka stands for. So they have the facility, they have the equipment to have a lot of people doing circus in one space, which is one reason why we haven't gone into like a convention center. You don't necessarily have the rigging capacity and all of that. So we try to, the festival is held every 2 years and we try to rotate, you know, is it held on the West Coast? Is it held in the Southwest? Is it held in the East Coast? That kind of thing, Midwest. So that people don't have to always travel so far. But then each circus school, like you mentioned, the program in New York, where there was a PE program that had Big Apple coming in, that school could decide, we want to send some kids to the circus festival. They would need to go with a chaperone. So you might say, this kid's mom is going to be the chaperone, and they're going to chaperone these 5 kids. And so the other kids' parents are trusting their kid to that known adult to travel across the country to go out to the festival. And then that adult is sort of their touch point while they're there. But you'll have.
I just had a visual of driving a minivan with 5 kids going to circus camp cross country.
It happened. It's awful.
Yeah.
You can check out our social media for the American Youth Circus Organization if you want to see great pictures from that festival.
So is there a 2024 date then?
So our youth festival is on the odd years. So there will be a 2025 youth festival. Usually it's in August. The specific dates are set by the host organization, so we don't have those yet. And then we actually have an educators conference that is every year. It alternates whether it's in person. So this year, since we had an in-person youth festival, we have an online educators conference, which is coming up. I don't know what the timeline is for getting this podcast out, but it's possible that if people are listening to it right away, they could come to the American Circus Educators Association online educators conference that will be held on November 11th and 12th, 2023. And you can go to AmericanCircusEducators.org to find more information about that conference.
Okay, perfect. This will be out before that, so people who are listening can look that up, and we'll put that link in the notes as well, so people can look through that. So as we kind of bring this to a conclusion, and I'm super curious. This was a 2019 publication, I think. Yep. So you've done some work on this. There's been other stuff going on that when we initially had our email exchanges, you talked about a lot of colleagues who are doing work in this area. You have a grad student who has published in this area. So like, what's like your burning question? What are you interested in? What do you feel like the next steps of research should be in this field in general?
Yeah. So this is maybe a bigger soapbox than just the circus thing, but what really got me interested in research in the first place was what I saw in practice in the circus space. So I was coaching. I had grown up doing circus as a kid myself. And I saw things happening in this space that I was feeling were absent from the literature. I was feeling like, I was studying these topics and not hearing about circus as an exemplar, but I was seeing it happen. And I think it's an example. It's not the only one, but it's a great example of how researchers have so much to learn from practice. And I'm sure that's true in PE as well as in the out of school time recreation space. I know in Dr. Holt's podcast about PYD, he was talking about the connection between research and practice as well. It's a big piece of PYD work is to not have the research just sit on the shelf somewhere. And he was talking about the need for more application of PYD research in sports setting. And I would like to pitch that and the opposite of more opportunities for researchers to learn from practitioners, opportunities for us to take a step back and see what's happening that could be really excellent, but maybe doesn't fit within our existing frameworks, right? So if I say I study youth sport, that probably excludes circus, right? It's not a competitive activity. It's not a sport, really. But there's so much to learn from it. And so that's sort of my bigger pitch for circus and other things that are understudied. I also did some work with Radar Savenbaum and Belinda Wheaton. Our paper in 2018 is about parkour and looking at how youths who don't feel like they want to participate in organized sport but do want to move their bodies in these athletic ways were self-organizing and experiencing PYD through this self-organized movement context. I think circus is another example of where, when we broaden our perspective on what's possible and what's already happening, we can see great things.
And when you talked about how circus wouldn't have fit if somebody identifies as a youth sports researcher, I immediately thought of parkour. And it's interesting that you then went to there as well, because parkour is something that if you go to elementary schools, and you ask, like, there's this program in Finland that I've been really interested in that is basically like a model for leisure sports in all of Finland. And the way the model works is that local municipalities go into school districts or schools or youth organizations, and they ask, they're like, what do you want to learn? And then they come up with a list, and then that organization hires somebody to teach that. So they create these programs. It's not an organization coming in and say, we offer soccer, we offer football, we offer basketball, do you want to play? And on all of those lists for kids, like when they say, what do you want to learn, on all of those lists is parkour. That's somewhere in there. And it's like, if you get your teaching license in a traditional PE program and you never do any professional development afterwards, you'd never even consider that parkour is something that students would like. Then when you look at what parkour is, it's like it's tremendously like developmentally appropriate. It's easy to implement. You don't have to have any extra equipment, and you can start learning how the body moves with around other people on top of objects and all of the stuff that if you open a textbook, how do I teach these skills? So I'd love to see where this goes, especially with the youth circus. And I love the connection between PYD. Reading your like theoretical framework of how you put SDT in and youth development. And I'm like, oh, I see how that connects. And I can see how all of these different levels of students choosing to do it and it being non-traditional from ball sports and stuff. And really, really love the study. So thanks for sharing.
Yeah, thank you so much. And thank you for the opportunity to share it with your listeners.
Awesome. And so everybody who's listening, there's a bunch of links in the show notes, and hopefully you can go in if you're interested in learning more on that November 11th and 12th online session. So thanks so much. And again, thanks to Alba Rodriguez for her help in producing the podcast. And that's all we got. Thanks, Jen.
Thank you.